This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis and Moscow. I welcome Anatol Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, writing at the Financial Times in these last days, asking the question, what is the Kremlin's power structure? Who are the Siloviki? Who is driving this aggressive war in Ukraine? And right now appears, according to the news, to be engaging in diplomatic conversation with Ukraine and perhaps other countries to resolve the conflict short of massacre and a larger war. I mention, before we turn to the Siloviki and the Kremlin, that there are episodes in these last days that seem significant that Anatol can address. One is the remarks by President Zelensky virtually to the U.S. Congress asking for more aid, no-fly zone, perhaps for a humanitarian corridor, and bigger and better weapons. There are many weapons being mentioned. This is not a conversation about arsenal. I mentioned that Zelensky asked Congress and especially President 24 hours ago, and today in the European papers, Zelensky is making another powerful remark, condemning Germany for being on the wrong side of the contest. As he says, business, business, business. You sell and you provide the resources for the Siloviki, for the Kremlin to conduct this war against liberty. Anatol, a very good day to you. The morning was suddenly, that saying, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. There was a rhyme this morning. A photograph in the Telegraph worldwide of a man preparing a sandbag redoubt on the beaches at Odessa. And in the near distance, you can see the waves coming in against the crossed iron bars that were arranged so prominently on the Normandy beaches in 1944. So here we are, rhyming, Europe at war. Who are the Siloviki, and how do they hear Mr. Zelensky's remarks to Congress and Mr. Zelensky's remarks condemning Berlin these last decades? Good evening to you.
Hello, John. Well, they are the, by now, very small group of chiefly former KGB officers or people linked to the KGB who surround Putin, and who it seems now are really the only ones with access to the president, and who also dominate a large part of the Russian economy through the positions that they've been appointed to. It's important to note that over time, you know, Putin's circle, so in other words, the Russian elites who have real power, has narrowed and narrowed. And I think, I mean, one important feature in the decision to go to war is that Putin's circle now doesn't include any economists. Indeed, even the Russian prime minister and government are considered to be actually very detached from the president now. So the isolation of Putin from good advice, and advice which is, you know, knowledgeable about the world, does seem to have contributed to this decision to launch this invasion of Ukraine. Of course, a problem here is that all of these men, they're all men, you know, have been themselves totally implicated in the decision to invade Ukraine. And therefore, you know, it will be very difficult to get rid of Putin without getting rid of the lot of them as well, which, of course, diminishes the possibility of a kind of internal coup in Russia to replace Putin.
The Siloviki, heading up the security apparatus, the national security apparatus, are not ignorant of what's happening in Moscow. They can see it. The unemployment is surging. The Russian Central Bank is without resources because of the decision sanctioning its foreign reserves. I'm told that there is difficulty, if not inability, to sell oil because banks are fearful of providing credit for the exchange for fear they'll be sanctioned. So they can hear reports of their resources plunging. The estimate of what the scale of the recession or depression will be is numbing. It's numbing. The people of Moscow, the people of Petersburg, are seeing their savings destroyed and are fleeing in many instances. There's a brain drain underway. Do you believe the Siloviki are deaf to this, are cut off from this? Certainly their children would tell them what's happening at the university. Classes are empty.
I don't think that they can be completely deaf to it. No, they must be hearing. Well, obviously, they're just looking at the economic statistics. And equally importantly, of course, the Russian army on the ground in more than 3 weeks has taken none of its key objectives. I mean, it is in the process, perhaps, of capturing Mariupol. It will capture a heap of ruins and of civilian corpses. But I think, I mean, my sense is that the Russian regime now knows that it cannot achieve its maximal objective in Ukraine of subjugating the whole country under Russian domination. And that is why we do now see a more intensive move towards a peace process and a peace settlement.
Anatol, what is a real Czechist? And is that flattery in the Kremlin?
Oh, in the Kremlin, undoubtedly. That's exactly what they see themselves as. It was an old Soviet phrase about the supposedly, the reality, believe me, was very, very different. But the supposedly noble, committed, very honest, I mean, ruthless, certainly, patriotic, ideologically fanatical character of the original communist secret police under Lenin. Their name was the Cheka. So Nastoyashiy Chekist was a phrase for somebody, you know, like that. And I'm sure that's how Putin sees himself. But in Soviet days, it was, as with so many of these official phrases in Soviet days, it also became the subject of innumerable jokes.
Let us entertain then the real Czechists. And 1939, 1940, Stalin, you'd have to say, represents a version of the real Czechists that you can emulate if you think of yourself as a cynical and ruthless man devoted to Greater Russia. Stalin came to realize that the Finland attack was going poorly, and he made deals. He found a way. You've mentioned that in the past. Are we closer to a Finland solution for the Kremlin than we were when we last talked a week ago?
Yes, I think that we are. President Zelensky has said that since it's obvious that NATO won't admit Ukraine, he has said that Ukraine can sign a treaty of neutrality. Of course, under the right conditions, with the right guarantees for Ukrainian sovereignty and independence. So you have the model of Finland, you also have the model of Austria during the Cold War. Russia has suggested that, you know, demilitarization could be scaled back to mean, obviously, not the dissolution of the Ukrainian army. That's absolutely unacceptable. But it could be under the Treaty of Neutrality, the exclusion of certain categories of missiles, the exclusion of foreign bases. I mean, that leaves open the very difficult issue of, which didn't apply in the case of Austria, of course, territory, you know, what happens to the territories occupied by Russia since 2014, Crimea and the Donbass. Now, of course, the point there is that in practical terms, Ukraine is not giving up anything because it lost these territories 8 years ago. Of course, in legal terms, Russia is demanding Ukrainian recognition. I mean, what is possible, of course, is that as with, the issue of the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, for example, the Ukrainians have suggested that these issues could be compartmentalized. In other words, they could be separated from the peace negotiations and left, you know, for future negotiations. I think perhaps the compromise there is that one of the reasons why Russia is insisting on recognition of Crimea is that in the 2 years before the invasion, the Ukrainians were blockading the water supply to Crimea, which was doing a lot of damage to the Crimean economy and to people there. So perhaps if both sides agreed that they wouldn't, you know, bring any kind of economic or military or infrastructural pressure to bear on each other pending negotiations, then, you know, we could kick this into the long grass, as it were.
How do you read now the little bit of information we have from the battlefield is unreliable, both sides' fog of war, but there is a deal of information coming from both Kyiv under siege and Moscow, that the conversations continue and that they're more realistic. These are vague words, but does that indicate that these two opposite parties are negotiating, or that there's an arbiter? Have you heard that there's someone at the table who's outside of this conflict that can make recommendations and guide these conversations? Otherwise, we both know there's a lot of stamping foot and walking out. And that happened in Korea for months and months and months.
Apparently, Israel is to some extent playing this role. And Israel is in a very, very good position to play this role, because Israel is in the unique position of having good relations with Moscow, with Kiev, and with Washington. So with all the, you know, the key players in this. So I think that actually Israel is playing a very positive role there. And certainly I think that the negotiations are now serious and are ongoing, because to some extent already we are in, you know, what has often been called a mutually hurting situation in Ukraine. You know, on the one hand, the Russians have suffered very heavy casualties. The Ukrainians are claiming, and the Russians haven't denied it, they haven't confirmed it, that Russia has lost four generals killed already. So, I mean, the Russian army is really being worn down. And, of course, it can only capture cities in the face of fierce Ukrainian resistance by destroying them, which, of course, is fatal for Russia's political goals. But on the other hand, of course, you know, Russia has occupied a lot of territory. It has occupied a large part of Ukraine's coastline in particular. It has linked up Crimea, you know, with Russia proper. And therefore, you know, if at some stage the Russians declare a unilateral ceasefire and challenge the Ukrainians to attack them, then of course, you know, Ukraine is, you know, going to suffer itself, great destruction and very heavy casualties. So I think there are strong incentives on both sides to try to reach an early agreement.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, who speaks the language of Russia, who has traveled widely in Russia and in Central Asia.
And Ukraine.
And Ukraine. Thank you, Anatole. And comes to this conversation looking for a way forward. When we come back, NATO has been extremely busy these last days, and there have been some hard words expressed by the leaders of NATO, especially the President of the United States. I believe he used the term war criminal about Vladimir Putin. What does the future look like? A post-conflict Europe. I'm John Batchelor.